This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're going to remember Sonny Bono. He died yesterday afternoon in a skiing accident. He was 62. Bono was completing his second term in the U.S. Congress. He was the second most requested speaker at House members' events during the 1996 campaign season. Although he ended up in politics, many of us know him best for his work in music and show business. He wanted to be a songwriter and got his start in the music business doing production and promotion at small R&B labels. Then he worked as an assistant to Phil Spector, perhaps the most important record producer in rock and roll history. Sonny Bono had his first big success as a songwriter with Needles and Pins, which he co-wrote with Jack Nitzsche and became a top 20 hit for the Searchers in 1964. But that was all behind-the-scenes work. It was when Sonny Bono teamed up with Cher that he became a star. He wrote much of their material, including Baby Don't Go, I Got You Babe, Laugh at Me, and The Beat Goes On.
The beat goes on. The beat goes on.
Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La da 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 dee. La da 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 da. Charleston was once the rage, uh-huh. Thing, uh-huh. Teeny Bopper is our newborn king, uh-huh.
And the beat goes on. The beat goes on.
When the Sonny and Cher act ran out of steam, Cher became a superstar and Sonny dropped out of show business. He opened up a restaurant in Palm Springs. He became mayor of the town in 1988, serving till 1992. I spoke with him in 1991, 3 years before he was elected to Congress. He said that when he was getting started in music, his idol was Frankie Lane, so he wrote his first song with Frankie Lane in mind.
Frankie Lane was the hot number when I was a kid in school, and he was the kind of real stylist then. So he had this sexy kind of drawl. I patterned everything after Frankie Lane. And when I wanted to sing, I tried to imitate him. And then I wanted to, when I wanted to write, I wanted to write for Frankie Lane. And by the time I started writing songs, though, Frankie Lane got cold, as we say in show business. So even if he could get a song to him, it didn't mean too much in that day.
So you tried to get a song to him?
Yeah, I did. I in fact did get a song to him. I think what he did, and he liked it very much. I think what he didn't, the part I didn't know, by then I was, 19 or 20. What I didn't know was that he was cold and he couldn't get a recording contract himself, but he owned a little independent record company.
And you got a job at that company, and that led you to other record companies.
Well, I was just a writer there. And that was Crystal Records. I was just a songwriter, and they liked all the songs I wrote, so they would see me often and see what I had. And my two stops when I went to Hollywood would be, I used to deliver meat, and I'd stop at two record companies mainly because of my reception. I'd stop at Specialty Records and Crystal Records. In Specialty Records, they liked my material as well. But Specialty was a very successful label. They had Little Richard, Don and Dewey. Then they had Sam Cooke as a soul stirrer. Then he wasn't Sam Cooke. He was one of the soul stirrers. But they were. They had Lloyd Price, Percy Mayfield, all these blues artists. So they were very successful as an independent label, incredibly successful.
Well, when you got a job at Specialty Records, one of your first songs was recorded by the group Don and Dewey, the rhythm and blues duo.
Yeah.
And the song was Coco Joe, and this is a song about the coolest monkey in town?
Yeah, right.
What led you to write the song?
Well, when I was a box boy at a store, they came out with a Coco Joe, and I thought, oh, what a great name, Coco Joe. And so I write this real cute little Calypso song, you know, because Calypso was happening, Belafonte was happening. That was when I was about 17. And then I get to Specialty and I sing it for Don and Dewey, and they are two raving hardcore blues singers. And so this little, in the jungle there's a monkey, that's the way that I sang it. And they go, in the jungle there's a monkey, bam, you know. And I never heard a song change personality so much in my life. Then later on, the Righteous Brothers recorded it. So actually, that was... probably the first or second song that I wrote.
Well, let's give it a spin.
Okay.
In the jungle, there's a monkey named Coco Joe, the coolest little monkey that you ever know. He don't have a tail like the other monkeys do. He trimmed it, it suede, and it dyed it blue. Coco Joe, let me tell you about a Coco Joe. With a crazy drink, you should see his walk, it's the funniest thing. He changed the stroll to the monkey swing. Coco Joe, now let me tell you about a Coco Joe. Coco Joe, the coolest little monkey in town.
Was it hard as a 22-year-old producer to work with a kind of wild rhythm and blues group like you were?
No, it was fascinating and fun. I loved it. I loved black music because that was they were much more liberal about what you wanted to sing or who you were or what your intention was, you know. In that day, Decca and Capitol and Brunswick and RCA were the hot labels, and they just had an attitude about music, and it had to be the certain thing. So it was like the big companies now. You couldn't get in. But you went to these black artist labels, you know, they were very flexible, very liberal, and allowed you to be. And so they overcame the music industry because of their attitude, but the black labels were that way. And you know, I first started with Johnny Otis, who let me record on his label, which was Dig Records, you know, and that was the first song I wrote called Ecstasy. So being in that environment with Little Richard and Don and Dewey and Larry Williams, I was in heaven, just absolute heaven.
Now, I'll confess, I just found out this week that you wrote Needles and Pins, and I feel bad. I should have known that you wrote that and should have, like, given you credit that for that, you know, in my mind.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of people, of all the songs I've written, that song, people go, I didn't know you wrote that.
Yeah.
I thought Jackie DeShannon wrote that.
I always just think of the Searchers, you know. I don't even think of Jackie DeShannon.
Yeah, nobody makes the association. So you're not alone.
So did you work on the lyrics?
I worked on it both.
You worked on both?
It was me and Jack Nitzsche, and I had hired Jack Nitzsche to write lead sheets for Specialty Records, and then we became very, very close, and we were like family to his family, and my family hung out together all the time. So... we talk about music and for days and hours and hours and days and months. That's all we talked about. And Jack could play a piano pretty well, you know. So he had this riff, you know, do 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 do, and he just couldn't get it out of mind. He goes, "I love this riff. I love this riff. I love this riff." So one night we had nothing to do, so it wasn't planned or preconceived. So we started fooling around, and then Needles and Pins came out, and pretty soon we had a whole song. So we just kind of assembled it, whatever parts we could contribute. So nobody specifically went to lyrics or music.
Well, the question I always wanted answered about Needles and Pins was whether you wrote Needles and Pinza, you know, now it begins.
Yeah.
Well, where did that extra syllable come from?
The Pinza. You're always looking for little hooks, what we call hooks when you write, you know. And it also comes from, I kind of always tried to fancy myself as a blues singer, if I could sing. And so blues singers always kind of added these little extra syllables to words or phrased differently. So it was a phrasing that I had. And Jackie DeShannon heard that phrasing, and she just jumped right on it.
We're listening back to a 1991 interview with Sonny Bono. He died yesterday in a skiing accident. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1991 interview with Sonny Bono. Now, you worked with Phil Spector for a while,
yeah.
as a promo man, and then helping him with production. As a promo man, what was your style in getting airplay on stations? I imagine it wasn't hard to get those records airplay.
It was a piece of cake. I mean, all I had to do was take a record into the station. When I was a promotion man for Philip, he was as hot as he could be, and they couldn't wait to get the next Phil Spector record. So, fortunately, I didn't have to do anything except get the record to the radio station.
Everyone who's ever worked with Phil Spector has great Phil Spector stories. One that you tell that I especially like in your new book is about how Spector would always practice looking cool. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Philip was the most unique creature I ever met in my life, especially at that time, because in the early 60s, all the things that were standardized were so embedded, nobody thought in different form other than what was standard, you know. So when you were a singer, you dressed standard. You had the little short suit with the string tie, and the whole world then was pretty conformed. So I get a job with Philip, and I meet this little guy who's just a total nonconformist. His hair was long. He dressed in the most bizarre fashion, and he produced in the most bizarre fashion. Before I wanted to work with Philip because I wanted to see how this guy produced. Up until then, when I produced, I'd have one piano, one guitar, two saxophones or whatever. And here you go in the studio and there's three pianos lined up, four guitars lined up, three drummers lined up, and I go, my God, what is going on here? You know, three percussionists, and then a whole sax section. So that was one session. I never saw anything like it in my life. So everything that Philip did was revolutionary. And when he recorded, he'd be wearing sunglasses, and he was just totally cool. And he was always aware that he was a performer. Philip really wanted to be the star. Anybody that sang really was an offshoot of Philip. So he was the star of his label, not the artist. You know, Darlene Love really didn't get that much recognition. Even Ronnie, it was Philip who was the real star. You know, so this guy lived that way. The funniest time I ever had with him trying to impress us was we shopped at the market on Vine Street, which was a big market at 12 o'clock, and he was a weird looking guy, and people looked at him, and pretty soon I was weird looking too because I wanted to be like Philip. And so he studied French lessons a little bit, so he said to me, he gave me French words to answer back to him, as he wanted us to pretend we were two French people in this market. And so he gave me French words to say back to him when he would say sentences. And so he'd say a sentence, and I'd absolutely screw up the response because I think the most difficult language in the world was French. But here we are in a supermarket, two idiots dressed bizarre, speaking French, hoping people would notice us. And that was Phil's style.
Among the many things you did was backup vocals for some of Spector's records. And you write that he used to call you his funk. Why?
Well, I have kind of a froggy voice, or I have a real nasally voice, and it cuts through everything. And so it's not a very smooth sound, but he liked it because it wasn't a smooth sound, and he thought it was funky, and it did cut through on the background. So I sang with the Blossoms and all the girls, and then later Cher joined me. And he liked that background sound, and he liked my voice in there. So when I hear the records today, Mary, I can still hear me, and so can my wife, Mary.
After working on production and promotion in the record industry, what made you think about becoming a performer yourself?
I always wanted to perform. As long as I could remember, I wanted to be in some form of show business. It's the only thing that ever really interested me. So however I could figure out a way to perform, I would try singing, but I really didn't have the pipes to be a singer. Or then I tried writing, and I just stayed in it, and I was good enough to sustain in the industry because I loved it so much that I could pull it off. So I just, as long as I could ever remember, I wanted to perform.
When you met Cher, you became a couple, and you performed together. You started off performing as Caesar and Cleo. What was the angle behind the names?
The angle then, in the 60s, you know, they had Dick and Dee Dee, Chubby Checker. Part of being an artist then was to come up with a gimmicky name as well. So nobody really had their real names. They always had these hook name, what we call hook names. So that was right when Cleopatra came out with Liz Taylor, and my haircut was as close, the closest thing they could call a haircut like mine then was a Caesar cut. And so, and Cleopatra was out, and I went, all right, Caesar and Cleo, that's got to be a hitting formula. What a great name. So that bombed real fast.
So when you became Sonny and Cher instead of Caesar and Cleo, how was Sonny and Cher different?
We were just a little more honest, and by then I think I had a little more awareness after watching Phil of how to approach a commercial market and how to write for it and how to produce for it. So I was much more on as a producer and arranger and songwriter. So I wrote "Baby Don't Go" for Cher, and with me doing the background. And it was a pretty commercial song, and I kind of felt it was right on. And when I wrote it, I left Phil, and I borrowed $135, and that's how much that record cost.
Wasn't the idea initially for you to produce Cher, but she was too nervous to sing by herself, so you ended up singing with her?
Yeah. Cher wanted to sing so badly, and I always wanted Phil to record her when he was singing background, but they got along like a dog and a cat. And so he would never record her except for Ringo, I Love You. I don't know if you remember that, but that was a quick brainstorm that Philip had when the Beatles emerged on the scene.
I don't remember it.
Yeah, and he called Cher Bonnie Joe Mason. So there is a record somewhere called "Ringo, I Love You" by Bonnie Joe Mason, and that's Cher singing Phil's brainstorm, and that bombed. Then I left, and I wanted to, because Phil just wouldn't record Cher, so I left, and then I wrote "Baby Don't Go," and she didn't like singing alone. She was really petrified of singing in those days. She was petrified of performing, and believe it or not, she still is. And so she felt more comfortable if I was out there or singing with her. So I just sang the choruses on "Baby Don't Go," and it became a what we called the soft hit. It hit in California and the West Coast, but it wasn't a national hit. But it was enough to get a career rolling for us.
What's the record of the records that you and Cher made together that you still like most? for the songwriting, the performance, or the production, all of the above.
Okay. There were a few that I thought were really, really exceptional. I thought I Got You, Babe was the moment that I produced it. I knew it was a hit. All this music balanced perfectly. The hook with the bassoon and oboe worked perfectly. So it was a tricky production that worked well. The most difficult production that I ever had was Bang Bang, not Bang Bang, You Better Sit Down, Kids, because that I'll remember all my musicians were the same guys, and they'd come in to see what we were going to do, and when they heard Better Sit Down, Kids, the way it was structured, going from 4-4 to 7-8 time, you know, they went, what is he doing? And so, but again, as it rolled out beautifully. And then using a gypsy violin with Bang Bang, I liked all those productions. I liked all those hooks. They were a real stretch, but they laid in right in that commercial vein.
You heard Sinatra's recording of Bang Bang, right?
Yeah, I did. I wish you would have put some tempo on it.
Sonny Bono, he died yesterday in a skiing accident. We'll hear more of our 1991 interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our 1991 interview with Sonny Bono. He died yesterday in a skiing accident at the age of 62. When we left off, we were talking about the Sonny and Cher era. Back then, people laughed at Sonny because of his outrageous clothes. While he was still with Cher, he had a solo hit called Laugh at Me.
Why can't I be like any guy? Why do they try to make me run? Son of a gun, now what do they care about the clothes I wear? Why get their kicks from making fun? No, so I don't care. Then laugh at me if that's not fair. I have to pay to be free. Then baby, laugh at me.
Well, you had been used to marketing other performers, and here you were trying to, like, produce and market yourself. What image did you want as a couple? How much of who you were as performers was, like, conscious marketing?
Well, there was a tremendous hook with dressing the way we did. I mean, I took Phil's idea and went into a packaged it more in a commercial fashion, and so we went even more obvious than Philip did, and we found these bobcat vests. We would have our bell bottoms made with just wild fabrics, and we were kind of unisex, both of us, and it had this real, real strong look. And our timing was perfect because, as I say, up until then, everything was a standard. So when we would go to a concert, people may not even have known who we were, but then when they saw us, they loved it, and it just caught on. The whole package caught on.
Sonny and Cher went through its high points and low points as a duo. What was the low point, and what was the most, like, horrible type of place to play?
The low point was kind of where you get ashamed, or I got ashamed of myself anyway, was, you know, achieving all this success as a musical act and then letting it slip away to almost oblivion, you know. And so it was a real low point for me, and I didn't know how to recover from it, and I didn't know what to do. Music had taken a left turn and gone in a totally different direction, and I couldn't philosophically hook up with it, and so I wasn't able to produce that kind of music. So I was kind of lost there, and that was absolutely the low point for us.
When was this?
That was about 68, 1968, 67. Actually, things went on the wane. After about 66, things started turning the other way, and I think I wanted us to get into movies and things, and I don't know if I concentrated enough in music. I probably lost the interest that I had prior to this success, and so I wasn't writing the songs the way I was writing when I was really hungry. And then music itself changed, so it was real hard to get back into the scene again. And eventually, we just couldn't get into it. So our market was gone. It was absolutely gone, and we were very cold. And so the only choice open to us then was to work nightclubs in hotels. There was still a nightclub circuit. Didn't pay very well. It would just keep you afloat, but at least you stayed in the business. And we did that. And now here we were working to thousands of kids, working to a couple hundred people in a nightclub audience. And it was way more intimate, way more scary. And Cher didn't like it at all because of the intimacy. And so she would avoid working directly with the audience. And sometimes both of us would, and so we started that repartee just to kind of keep our spirits up on stage. It was sort of a, oh, well, screw 'em attitude, you know. Let's just be us. So we would tease each other, and it caught on. And so we continued with that, and as it caught on, it became more and more sophisticated and got incorporated into the act. And then a CBS executive, Fred Silverman, saw us at the Americana Hotel and gave us a summer show, and we were back on the scene again.
Why did you have a hard time keeping in the music business after you and Cher split up?
Why did I have a hard time staying? I had a hard time staying in anything after Cher and I split up. I think part of what the show did was... although I don't believe it, and I will always defend this, it was kind of like, well, Cher is the talented one and Sonny is like the doofus. But that image, I think, went across to America. And so when Sonny and Cher split up, Cher had more attraction and attention in the industry, and they just dropped me, period. So nobody was in when the phone rang. And I just couldn't get into the industry at all. And to compound it, I really didn't want to let go of Sonny and Cher. And to talk about confused, I guess that was the most confused time, because I didn't know anything else other than the industry. So I didn't know what to do, and I kept pursuing it. And the more I pursued it, the less response I got. And finally... the only thing that you can do in that business when you were once somebody and then not somebody is you can work a lot of love boats. So I think I held the record on Love Boat, and I'll never forget one day I was doing Fantasy Island, same producer, Aaron Spelling. So I do Love Boats and Fantasy Islands, and I'm sitting in a trailer, and I'm going, what am I doing? I said, you're either on your way up or your way down. So it was very, very depressive. You know, it wasn't as glamorous as I wanted it to be or as it's supposed to be, because you're really on your way down. And I think when I called Hervé Pontoon in my scene, I forget what his name was, but it wasn't Pontoon. God sent me a message. Get out of there.
How did you end up getting into politics after music?
Politics, well, the first thing that I had to do was I had to let go of Sonny and Cher, let go of the career, let go of all of that, and just be okay with me again. And then eventually I did start at the bottom. I opened a restaurant, and I was a busboy, a cook, everything. And I was the happiest I had been again because I was creating my own actions. So no matter what it was. And when I let go of Sonny and Cher, my wife came into the picture, and we were having a good time. We moved down to Palm Springs. I had a home there for 17 years, and I wanted to get into business there, and I dealt with the city, and they seemed incredibly illogical to me about a lot of things. I needed a sign, and I was remodeling a house, and they weren't nice about it. And we would have these silly arguments about nothing, and I said, don't you realize you're holding back the growth of this town? And so then they red-tagged me because I was being a smart mouth to them. So then I went and talked to the mayor, and I said, look, mayor, you need this kind of thing in your town. And he was very nice about it, but they still didn't respond. So I said, well, I'm going to run for mayor then. And so I ran, and I didn't really stay stuck on my own particular issues, but I did start to notice that the town was sliding backwards, and that I felt it was moving in the wrong direction, and that it needed to be brought up into a contemporary period. So I got dedicated to it, and I enjoyed it. And so I landed on my feet in Palm Springs as a mayor.
Sonny Bono. He died yesterday in a skiing accident. He was 62. When he died, he was completing his second term in the U.S. House of Representatives. Our interview was recorded in 1991.